All right, so this is the last of these revenge shows. I gotta come up with some kind of dumb song thing for the opening. Man, what was even popular in the early 2000s? This is so much easier for, like, the 90s and the 80s, I swear. Gotta find something here. What was that? I can't even think of anything. What was that? Oh, there was that fucking Britney Spears song, right? That's easy. Kind of lazy. It's probably, like, of course I'm gonna use that, but whatever. I can't think of anything else. Let's see if I can find a karaoke version of that. What the hell am I even gonna do for the lyrics? Whatever, I'll just wing it. Oh, here we go. Fuck it. Fuck it. I don't care.
Oops, we podcasted again. Here's a disclaimer. The views and opinions on this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. I hope you enjoy the show. Hey, it's a podcast.
Oh, God. Right, that was awful. All right, I'm going to have to find something else. Thank God no one's ever going to hear that. Ugh.
Okay, so that brings us to number five. We're at the halfway point, and this time we're going to start out with Hope. Hope, you're number five.
All right, well, in keeping with the whole everything is under a specific trend, I think it can't be, it can't really be diminished, it can't be undermined how important good children's or good family animation is. And, you know, principally because I think the attitude that you have towards animation when you're young kind of dictates what you are able to see from it when you get older. Like, you know, I think people that are big animation fans grew up on the best movies, the best Disney movies from the Disney's first golden age. And now a lot of people are in their 20s that grew up in on stuff from Disney's second golden age. And they're, you know, big animation fans, and they see animation as having greater potential than just being, you know, shitty cartoons for kids or something like that. And so, yeah, with some also-rans such as, like, Denu Coil or Spirited Away, my number five is the best children's anime ever made, Princess Tutu.
Okay.
I think it does a really good job of both capturing children's animation, imagination for animation, I should say. Those two words sound the same. But capturing children's imagination at a really young age and sort of fostering it for into a desire for meaning in the narrative and understanding. And Justin, you mentioned that with supervision, like, oh, maybe kids could see it, but, you know, like there's some dark stuff later on. I think it's really...
Early on, Mujo spends a lot of time naked for some reason too.
Well, he doesn't have a schlong, but you know, to be fair. But yeah, that's also sort of a Japanese thing of a naked. Oh, that's no problem. You know,
right.
Over here naked. Oh no. But ignoring cultural differences, like it's very clearly meant for children in Japan, and anime on the whole is still kind of considered a younger viewer thing. Like as many adults that enjoy it over here, like anime is like animation in the West. It's like, oh, that's for kids to a significant degree in the mainstream. And so when you pour this much thought and attention and meaning into something that really would just only be marketed to kids at first, because A Princess Tutu, I don't think the first half is weak necessarily at all for its audience. Like, I think it gets you to care about those characters through kind of the slow build of what you're used to, of what you're expecting, particularly for its age group. And then by the time it gets harsher, you're ready for it. You've become entrenched in the world. You love the characters, and you're ready to accept some of the harder twists. It doesn't feel abrupt. It feels very natural. My sister, who was 8 years old at the time that she watched it, watched it with me, and she adored it. I think it's her favorite anime ever at this point. And she was able to understand it completely because it doesn't challenge right off the bat in ways that you can't handle. But it sort of like enlightens very slowly over time. And it's amazing the forethought that went into using the classical and ballet pieces the way that they did. Both the sound of them, like just how they're going to sound, like the aquarium, what's it called? Something of the animals, that symphony, like they use the aquarium, piece from that to kind of convey mystery, but also, I don't know. Like they had a big list of like why they used the pieces that they did on the extras for the DVD, which are great. The DVD set for Princess 2 has a lot of really cool extras on it that help you learn a lot about both the production of the show and like why they used the music pieces that they did. And I don't know. It's really amazing how much thought, attention, love, and care went into a show for children to the extent that like anybody of any age can enjoy it. And it is thought-provoking, and it is a little daring and a little dark, and it's episodic, so it takes on a lot of different ideas. And by the end, like, you know, if you're really attached to those characters, you're sort of bouncing up and down and squealing and crying and, you know, whatever. At least that was my experience with my 8-year-old sister. So, yeah, as a tribute to getting people to love animation from an early age, which is very important, number 5, Princess Tutu.
Well, all right. I never really looked at it as a children's series so much, although I could definitely see how it would be, but I appreciated it just as a title. I thought one of the most amazing things it did was to actually make the music as much the story as the story itself. And it's a very, very rare thing to see that done in animation. I mean, you pretty much have to, if you look outside of the realm of anime, you're probably looking at something like maybe Fantasia to get a similar effect. And I was especially impressed with the end of both of the major story arcs in that sense. I thought they did absolutely beautiful jobs of integrating the music into the story and really building up Princess Tutu as a pretty impressive character, because you're basically talking about a character who's fighting against fate and trying to inject hope into a world where there really isn't any. So, because it's been
a lot of that meta content for adults that kids aren't necessarily going to get, but it's not over their heads. Like they can sort of begin to see things in a way that they hadn't really before, which is to see the structure of stories and the subversion of fairy tales. But it's not too much for them to handle. But adults appreciate it obviously more.
One thing I want to point out about Princess Tutu that I think is amazing is how it gets it tonally just about perfect. Yes. I mean, how many children's cartoons, if we're to really categorize this as a children's show, manage to make something that adults don't cringe at all? I mean, the only people that I think can even do that consistently is maybe Pixar. And Disney on rare occasion, although they occasionally slip into stupid land. But the only thing that's a little bit off and a little bit silly that adults might chafe at even a little bit in Princess Tutu is arguably Mr. Cat.
I love Mr. Cat. I thought maybe PK and Lillier.
Most people do.
Yeah. And Lillier were a little bit trying for me, but
okay.
I'm biased toward cats. I see completely what you're saying, that he may be a little much, but, you know.
It's one of those, it's his part is small enough that you can just parse it off as, okay, well, it's a fairy tale.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't respond to that show as strongly as y'all did. Maybe down the road I'll take another quack at it.
I literally just took a sip of tea when he said that, and it took everything in my power not to spit all over my monitors.
Well, that brings us to your number 5, Justin, so you're up.
Okay, my number 5, actually, we discussed around this time last year, so I'm not going to go too in-depth into it, but it is great, and it needs to be brought up. It is Wolf's Rain.
Okay, yeah, this will come up.
Yeah. It is this show has its pacing problems mostly because of how its little tortured production history and the whole SARS outbreak, yada, yada, yada. That said, if you could just trim out a little bit, it would be one of the best things ever made, especially the ending, which is just, I'm not sure how you could watch that ending without choking up. It is spectacular.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we're going to revisit this, so I'll save my comments till then.
Yeah, yeah, it's one of those where there's a few shows where it's like, we'll talk about this later.
Yeah.
Well, for sure. I guess I'm going to be the odd man out on this one because, frankly, I found the whole thing dull and pretentious. So,
well, what do you know, Theron?
It just didn't work.
Yeah, Theron. Throws tomatoes.
So I'm gonna be the outlier on this one, I guess.
No, we need those. So no, trust me. As much as I love that show, and I know Hope loves that show, Justin loves that show. Fully aware that it has its detractors, and not without reason.
It's not a perfect show, but the emotional impact is just what hooks me, and I'll always remember it for that.
And suddenly, a giant walrus rose up.
Oh, fuck.
I love that giant walrus fight, but that is, yeah.
Okay, all right. So since we'll get into Wolf's Reign in a bit here, but Theron, that brings us to your number five.
All right. Well, as far as my top five in general is concerned, I basically saw there's being two different levels here. My number one and number two are like head and shoulders above the rest, and then there's my number three and five, which are all in a cluster about equal quality shows. And basically, which one is my number five versus my number four versus my number three pretty much varies depending on my mood, I guess. Mm-hmm. For this exercise, the number five I decided to go with on this is my pick for the top mecha title of the decade, and that would be Flag.
Okay, I want to hear about this because I think this one defines underappreciated and underseen.
Yes, absolutely. And the thing is, right now, you can get three of the four volumes for it incredibly cheap if you go looking for them. One of the volumes, as somebody mentioned earlier, unfortunately, very hard to find because there was some kind of production problem with it, I guess. So that's like the second of the four, I think. Mm. But the other three you could get for probably about $10, $12 total if you go looking around for them. So it's... There's still a fair number of copies of this out there because I get the impression it never really sold well at all.
Mm-mm. No. Mm-mm. Huge bomb.
Yeah, and that's really unfortunate because, honestly, I think Flag is possibly the most daring of all the titles that are on here. This is a title that it's set in a real-world setting, very, very near future setting. It is set in a fictional country that's basically heavily implied to be somewhere – to be kind of a cross between Afghanistan and Tibet. Well, not Tibet, Nepal, excuse me. Because it has some actual religious elements that are present in those areas that's present in the series. And it involves a UN force that's basically trying to settle the country down from a period of civil war and get everybody to come to the table for a peace agreement, inspired partly by a award-winning picture of a flag that's pretty much inspired everybody to peace. And problem is, behind the scenes, the flag has gotten stolen. So there's a secret, basically, strike force that's been gathered to, like, a flag retrieval mission. And they are using Mecha to do this. And the way the story is presented, the main characters, one of the two main characters, Sayeko, is like an embedded journalist in this secretive unit. And she was chosen because she was the one who took the famous picture of the flag in the first place. Now, the first of the remarkable things about this that I thought was, here you have a case where the picture of the flag that's supposed to be inspiring everybody actually is pretty damn impressive picture. I mean, you can see a lot of disappointments about this. Well, they'll like play up to these songs and anime where they say, oh, this is like the greatest pop song ever. And then they play us like, really? But that's not the case with this picture. You look at this picture and you could see how that picture could inspire people to come to the table and make peace. The most remarkable aspect about the series, and this is why I think it didn't work well for a lot of people, is that the entire film is told documentary style. Every single scene in the film is shown through a camera's lens, whether it's the lens of the main characters or like a lens inside a military vehicle that's recording missions or something like that. Every single shot is through a lens like that. And it's edited in snippets so that it can kind of pop around and so, okay, this scene right here, this scene right here, this scene right here. And in the process, it kind of basically avoids having to worry about continuity issues because this is a collection of snippets that are put together as a documentary. And it's a really fascinating approach to anime making. There's no other anime series that does this. On top of that, it also brings up some highly controversial and politically charged issues. I mean, there's probably not another anime series which goes to the daring places that this one does. There's one line in the series, one point where one of the main characters says, the UN's calling anybody that won't work with them a terrorist, huh? And that's, if you really think about it, that's a pretty provocative statement. And the curious thing about this is this series was made, I think, in 2006, and it feels every single bit as relevant right now as it did when it was made. So I can see why a lot of people would be reluctant to try this one out, but boy, it's one of these series that will start to impress you early on, and then as it gets rolling, you see if there's an actual serious story and a lot of tension to it, it gets all the more impressive. It's also made by the same guy who made Gasaraki. So it's probably the most technically detailed of all mecha series too. So if that's something you're interested in, this is a really strong choice.
And Votoms, Rurisuke Takahashi.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay. I didn't finish Flag. I need to, I want to. But it's a lot better than Gasaraki.
It's got a pretty provocative finish too, because there's basically it climaxes in episode 12, and then you think this is going to spend episode 13 kind of winding down. Then something happens in episode 13 that just like, well, pretty much a mind blowing kind of plot twist. And the stuff that's implied about why that twist happens is really, it's like, wow, did they really go there kind of thing. So
yeah, it gets dark.
Yes, it does.
I love this show, but I have to admit that the whole found footage camera viewfinder aspect, didn't work for me. I still love the show in spite of that says something, because that's literally the entire show. But there were times where I'm like, okay, are you just perpetually just forgetting that your record button's on? I mean, there is no reason why this would be on someone's SD card, most of this show, if this was actually what it purported to be. And also, it seemed like a kind of an elaborate ruse to save on what was clearly a low budget.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that.
Yeah.
I thought it was an especially clever trick for getting around the low budget thing. So,
yeah, I mean, arguably too clever. That said, I mean, it is so smart about its politics and its intrigue, and it's smart on enough levels that you can forgive that if you're open-minded enough. But I can see how a lot of people, it's going to be a big minus.
Curiously enough, I've never seen Flag, and Gasaraki wasn't ringing a bell, but when you said Votoms, of all things, I was like, oh, Votoms, oh, Blue Gender. So now I have a better idea of maybe even if those aren't the better things to compare it to. I think Votoms and Blue Gender, I get a specific idea. I don't know if it's anything like Flag, but if it is, I might be interested. So.
Yeah, I just want to point out, Justin, everything you said about the weaknesses of found footage as a framing device. Everything you said about Flag applies to pretty much everything in the found footage genre. Like,
yeah,
that's
pretty
just
much
an overall problem. Like every complaint you just made, you could have also been talking about Paranormal Activity. So, yeah,
right.
The universal issues with found footage as a genre, but yeah,
Chronicle was good. Damn it,
had the same problem.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think Chronicle's the best found footage movie that I've seen, just because it was able to humanize the people in the footage. But there you go.
Right. Okay. So Flag. There's number five. That brings us to mine, which we've already talked about. It's Bacano. I don't know how you say it. I don't really have anything to add on to what Hope was saying, other than, you know, I've mentioned the show before. It's in my top 10 all time. And with good cause. Like, you pointed this out, that it's just so goddamn entertaining. And one of the things about it that I feel like if you're curious about the show and you haven't seen it, all you gotta do is watch the opening credits. That's it. And you're gonna be hooked. And if you watch the opening credits and you rightfully think, this looks like it's going to be a fucking blast. It is. The whole show is just about as fun as that opening sequence is. And the story is it's a mess. Like, it's a chaotic mess. And often it gets difficult to... I found myself having trouble following, like, what exactly is going on in this show. But it all comes together. And like you said, all the characters are really, really likable. And they're despicable people for the most part. But something about that show makes them all cuddly. And, like, you just want to follow them. And you mentioned Lad Russo. And anytime he wasn't on screen, I was saying, where's Lad? Like, I want him to be on screen all the time. Because that character... And the dub is... really, really good for the most part. I expected the dub to be garbage because...
accents.
You know, accents, because accents. And it's some of them great. I have a problem with some of them, but Lad is a really amazing dub performance. But yeah, no, but that show is a ton of fun, and I'm really glad that the Blu-rays are coming out again so people have another chance to pick it up. It can be had relatively cheap, but this is also one of those, like, the cheapest option. It's been in and out of print so much that, like, I was looking on Amazon. So, like, volumes 1, 3, and 4 are $1 each. And volume 2 is $100. You know, one of those.
Wait, wasn't it a put in a complete series?
It was, and those boxes are all way out of print. So, like, you can get it, but... and the Blu-rays especially went out of print real fast, but they're reissuing it, so... yeah, no, good times, man. I really, really enjoyed that show. It just for pure entertainment, and it's one of those things where it could have been a confusing fucking just mess from start to finish where, hey, you've read this book, here's scenes you may remember. It comes together, and it's accessible. So, yeah, awesome show.
Speaking of those books, man, it flopped in Japan, tragically, because Durarara did pretty well, and I watched Durarara, and that first two-thirds is pretty good. And then...
I didn't
mad at that last third.
I didn't even make it 5 episodes into Durarara. There's something about that show that just did not grab me.
I made it to halfway point.
It's not even nearly as good as Bakano. Not nearly, but I mean, I was willing to give it some allowances. But it took off. Bakano did not, which means we're not going to see more of it, which means I really wanted to read the book. I love the books. I love those characters that much because those books go on. And I was in L.A. and there was a Kinokuniya bookstore, I think. Something like that, and I walked in, and I here they were, all the light novels, and I picked them up, and I think for just like 10 minutes or so, just like flipped through, looking at the pictures and going, I wish I could read you. I can't read you. I'm so sad. And they're not gonna be. I mean, somebody bring those over. I don't know. I'm sad. I know. I want to know what happens to Lad and Alcatraz. I want to know.
Right, yeah. That would be nice to get some of that stuff. But that is a damn entertaining show. And
weren't two of the characters in Bakano? Didn't they make a brief cameo appearances in Durarara?
Yeah.
Yes, they did. And boy, and I watched that in the dub. Well, I watched it in sub first, but I watched that in the dub, and oh god.
Yeah,
you could have tried harder. You could have tried to voice match. They didn't try.
Yeah.
All right, anyway, so that's my number 5, and let's move on to the user lists. ML Ball Blue lists Ghost in the Shell, Standalone Complex, number 2, Fooly Cooly, number 1, Haruhi Suzumiya. Lack of Haruhi, which was a defining show of the mid-2000s, late-2000s. Not seeing it a lot, almost at all.
I'm blaming the second season.
Justin, you said it didn't even make your list, and I know you were a huge fan.
Yeah, it made my almost rounds. It's... The problem with it is that once it finds its legs in the second season and the movie, it ends up not being as fun, and it basically trades in its fun for going somewhere, and it makes you realize, oh, this show wasn't actually about going anywhere. This was about having fun.
Yeah,
and that just kind of soils the memory, in my opinion, because that first season is a blast.
Yeah.
I would fully agree.
Okay. B. Takeo lists Millennium Actress Genkutsuo, Gurren Lagann, Ronan Willis, Haibane Renmei, Spirited Away, Razafan, first mention of Razafan, Wander Kaiju lists Fooly Cooly, Razafan, Haibane Renmei, and Giga Shame lists Kurenai, Millennium Actress, and Mind Game. So those are some more user lists for you, and that brings us to number four. And we're going to start with Justin. Justin, your number four.
My number four is a show that I know did not make your list. You talked about it earlier, but it has been a favorite of mine since it first aired, and I love it to death. It is Victorian Romance Emma.
Right. Okay.
Does it feel Downton Abbey-ish? Yes, it does. I like Downton Abbey,
so do
in spite of the second season,
yeah,
which we will not talk about.
Yes.
I think that's missing the forest for the trees, to be honest. The power of Emma is in its details. There is an attention to small details in the show that I simply don't see in other anime, especially other TV anime. What other anime takes place in a Western English-speaking country that doesn't have any English or even any misspellings? All right, that doesn't make it a great show, but
something.
It shows you an attention to detail. Now, take that attention to detail. I mean, imagine all these, you know, hundreds of animators working on a show and making sure the spelling's right under, you know, the slavery conditions of the anime industry. Take that same attention to detail and apply it to body language. Apply it to mood. Apply it to what's going on behind the character's eyes in a society that no one actually says what they're thinking. That is what makes Emma special, in my opinion. And, I think, like every other fan, my heart broke a little bit when Right Stuff licensed it, and they couldn't justify the cost of producing a dub, because, yes, this show really needs to be in English. Putting that aside, it is a very sweet story with a lot of humor and a lot of really lovable characters. And really works with something that Japan and UK had in common, which is a heavy class system that both countries are still trying to rid itself of, and a kind of oppression of emotion that somehow has to be worked around if people are going to connect with each other, especially from two different strata of society. It was incredibly compelling, in my opinion, and it'll be a show the memory of which I'll take to my grave.
So it's like Remains of the Day, only happier, perhaps?
That's a good way of putting it, although there are plenty of dark moments, too. I think it really... One thing about the original manga by Kaoru Mori is that you can tell that the original manga artist just totally fetishizes Victorian England. And they did a good job of carrying her awe of the period through. So they take every step to ensure that you are as awed by that era as you have the potential to be. But at the same time, they'll take just as much gusto in watching Emma get up at the crack of dawn to go out and scrub down the iron bars on her front entranceway. Just these little details that make a moment, even if there isn't as much story as there might otherwise be, and it moves kind of slow. It's those little details that really bring you into that alternate reality.
Okay, so yeah, it's your number four, Victorian Romance Emma, and Theron. That brings us to you.
Okay, well, my number four probably won't really surprise anybody that it's on my list, because I've talked about this title before, I think even on ANN cast, and it's the title that I regard as probably the best written anime series that's been made to date, and that is Koikaze.
Okay.
I recently rewatched that for the first time in about 3 or 4 years, and I was expecting to be a little downgrade my opinion a little bit on it, but no, it still held up incredibly well. It's for those who aren't familiar with the title, this is a story that from the beginning is pretty direct about the fact that it's going to be about incest. But unlike all of the other titles that have come out in the last few years, which have kind of been increasingly sensationalizing it with all this emoto crap and all that, this one takes a very serious, unsensational look at a very delicate subject. It's This is a series that could have easily gone in really sour directions, but it's handled very delicately and in a very heartfelt sense, and it makes a viewer appreciate that this is not something that either character really wants. It just kind of happens. The main character spends pretty much a good chunk of the series basically trying to fight against the attraction, and he knows all along that it's wrong, and he just ends up knowing that it's wrong, ends up just not being enough. There's another character that's a friend of the main character that eventually gets the sense of what's going on and tries her damnedest to put a stop to it, and she just can't. So I found it to be a very emotional series in the end. It asks some very deep questions about how people can live with themselves once they get involved in that kind of a situation. And I thought it's a truly remarkably written series. On the downside, it's not one of the better looking series of the decade. I mean, I thought the animation and artistic effort on it were very mediocre.
Cotton mouths.
Yeah. Yeah.
White cotton mouths.
Yeah. And, but yeah, beyond that though, it's a really extraordinarily made series. It's also part of the answer to a curious trivia question. Name two completely unrelated series that have a character with the exact same first and last name in. Because there is a character in this prominent character in this series named Konami Chidori, who is of course also one of the main characters in the Full Metal Panic series.
Right, yeah. So tell me, do you have the version of that show that came with those really tasteless, weird stickers?
Yes, and that's.
There's
a couple of little issues. Some of the extras, a couple of the like next episode previews they did were kind of twisted, to put it mildly.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of forget that they exist, honestly, and just concentrate on the episode content.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those shows where people are like, I have heard nothing but praise for it in terms of, hey, man. This show's about incest, but it's for serious. I will admit, I've never watched it. And I'm friends with the people who dubbed it, and they certainly had their off-the-record comments about dubbing a show that was about incest. But it's one of those things where maybe someday I'll actually sit down and watch Koikaze. But so far, I just haven't done it.
I saw a few episodes, and I respected it. But I couldn't get past the squick factor. I just couldn't. And I acknowledge that's my failing. Not the shows, but I just couldn't do it. That said, it's there is no other hook to this show. Unless that human interest grabs you and you're sympathetic for the characters, If that doesn't work for you, there's literally nothing else in the show to grab onto.
Agreed.
So
that and only that.
Yeah. So if the squick factor bothers you as much as it does me, there ain't nothing for you here, I'm afraid. Maybe. I mean, that was a long time ago, and I might be much more sympathetic now that I'm a little older. I should probably give it another shot. But yeah, it's been out of print for how many years now?
Yeah. Well, it is worth pointing out though that the again, it does have that kind of squick factor, and I could see how some people could react to it. But this, unlike a lot of these recent incest-themed series, it's not in your face about it.
And well, that's the other thing.
It's a lot more tolerable.
It's not a fetish show, right?
No, it's not.
Yeah. No.
Which everything else we're talking about, all the things you can pay, those are specifically fetish shows.
Right. Yeah. And also, incest is now so ubiquitous that any shock value the show might have had then, I'm sure, is highly diluted now.
It's ubiquitous in anime.
In our little sphere of weirdness, yes.
Yeah.
My experience with Koikaze, I got it for a review from our good friend. I don't think he'll mind me calling him out here because he's in the review itself. Dorcas Aurelia said, you review this for me, please. And I was like, okay. And I sat down and I watched the whole thing in one sitting. I couldn't look away. I was just like, I can't, this is, Theron's right. Like, the characters are extremely well-written. And one of the taboos that he's not mentioning, like, A, they're brother and sister. B, they're not, they weren't raised together. They were raised apart, and that makes it difficult for, it's basically they have to move back in together because of a falling out or a reconsolidation where they're both living with their paternal father, but they don't know each other. And there have been studies done on this, and apparently that is actually a thing. It's fascinating. You kind of can't look away from it. I respect it more than I like it just because of personal proclivities, but I think it kind of closes the book on studying incest romance. Like, it does it the best that topic ever needs to be approached. But yeah, it's not a fetish show to such an extent that there's not a single fan service shot. I mean, there's not anything. Like, the girl is not, like, overly attractive. The guy is certainly not overly. They look like normal people, and there's not one single shot in the whole thing that could even be remotely misconstrued as a fetish shot. It's just a story about two people that were brother and sister that fell in love, and it plays it straight, and it's like, well, that I don't think anything else needs to be said about that. Like, that you're not gonna get any more revelatory and on the topic without being squicky or too self-indulgent than Kwekaze. So, yeah.
Well, and another thing too, is that besides just the incest thing, this is also an age difference story.
I forgot. Yeah, there's like 12 years between them.
Yeah, because he's 26 and she's like 15. Well, 15 at the start. I think she turned 16 during the course.
Yeah, she's almost 17 at the point. They're like, hell with it. Let's go out.
Yeah. So it's like there's that mid-20s guy with the mid-teens girl kind of thing going on there too, but it still makes that work too. And it's got an absolutely beautiful first episode. There's one shot where they're in a Ferris wheel that's, I think it's the picture that we're using on the encyclopedia entry here at ANN, and it's just such an that was almost a tearful moment for me. It's like, this was like, I think, the first series I ever watched where the first episode almost made me cry. So, it really had an impression on me, too.
It all would go, like, the whole series, every little bit of it, it's on such thin ice, would go completely out the window if they did anything to make the characters not seem real, to make the romance seem created for its own sake, just a shock, whatever. But it's the thinnest ice possible, and they make it to the other side. So you got to respect that, at least.
Okay, Kwekaze, check it out, I guess.
If you can.
If you can, yeah, if you can. All right, so Hope, that brings us to your number five.
Wait, number four?
Four, I'm sorry. Hope, that brings us to your number four.
I am confused. My number four, now speaking to a different kind of tier of enjoyment, one that I place above the others, I suppose, which is the difficulty that comes with creating a TV series, a serialized saga that spans, 13 to 26 episodes and feels like maybe a really long movie. Like, you could take the core concept and boil it down into a film, but they stretch it out and they make it feel like one continuous experience. So you get to the end of one episode and it's like, I must continue. Like, it doesn't feel serialized. And that's hard. That's hard to make it feel like there's no fat, there's no anything, but you keep coming back and coming back and coming back until it's over. And to accomplish that and make it thrilling. Some also-rans here, that has substance. That isn't just a pure entertainment thing. It has some substance to it and is a complex a story as it needs to be for its runtime. Some also-rans here. Razaphon, and curiously enough, as much as I wanted to avoid it, this is not a personal favorite, but I can't help but respect how it executes what it's trying to do. Death Note. Nothing but respect for taking... I've read those manga, though they are dry, they are a little insulting sometimes. It's, they took that and they made it as cinematic as possible. It feels like it was created for the screen. It's so... the tone is weirdly consistent. It takes itself too seriously, but knows it is. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's completely involving. But that's not actually the number four. It's just indicative of the kind of show that I'm looking for. Number four is Gankutsu Count of Monte Cristo. And it is a ride from the beginning to the end. It is extremely involving. It pulls the best elements. I love that book, Count of Monte Cristo. It's a great adventure book. And it's... basically takes that story, takes the events, keeps fairly true to them, and switches the point of view entirely. The book, of course, is told from the perspective of the Count of Monte Cristo himself. And the series, being aimed at a younger audience, didn't really want to, you know, not when I say younger, it's a little adult, that series. But when I say younger, I mean 15, 16-year-olds. Decided it wanted to flip the perspective to the son of the man that the Count wants vengeance on. And in order to do that, and yet keep the story consistent and keep it entertaining and develop the characters as much as need be, even if that means deviating from the book, and still keep the spirit of the book and still make it accessible to somebody who's just never experienced that story before, and then put it in space. And they did all of this, and it still works great. The real pinnacle of this kind of show is actually from the 90s, is Escaflowne. But if you could kind of take the pure, not a slice of fat in the whole thing, really long movie, narrative, cinematic epic stretched out to 26 episodes and put in the aughts, it would be Count of Monte Cristo. Just absolutely wonderful story, full of terrific characters, some great themes and ideas. Thrilling, visually quite astounding, even when it's a little bit much. I never was too overwhelmed by the visual choices in Count of Monte Cristo. People that have seen it know what I'm talking about. It's pretty trippy. But, you know, maybe it overextends itself a little bit, but not to the detriment of the story. It's never, like, hard to follow visually. It's just a little bit overwhelming. But, yeah, starts great and ends great. I think maybe the only weak point is it gets a little too melodramatic, even for its own sake. Right before the end, there's, let's say, a Mexican standoff near the very end of the show that they draw out. Boy, do they draw out that Mexican standoff at the end. French standoff, perhaps. But apart from that, just the amount of effort that would go into writing something and keep it thrilling at the end of every episode and yet have it feel like a really long movie, a cohesive cinematic accomplishment. Yeah, really incredible. Count of Monte Cristo, number 4.
Cool. Yeah, I revisited that for a bit and realized, like, this was fun. And that's kind of it. Not that there isn't a little bit more going on in that show, but there's kind of, no, maybe there isn't. It's visually, you know, it's obviously that is the first thing anyone will notice about that show. It's how unique it looks. But I don't disagree with anything you said. However, for whatever reason, it didn't make it on my list. Maybe that was closer to an also-ran that I'm giving it credit for. But no, it's a really good show. People should seek it out. I think it's still in a save edition.
It's so cheap right now.
Yeah, it's like $20.
It's easy to get.
I'm kicking myself for buying like really expensive discs, but I wanted to pay a little bit of mind to the dub here because there are some really, really great characters, actors in the dub, and some really, really terrible performances, and they're so intermingled that I can't decide whether or not to recommend it.
And I don't. I recommend it if you are not used to reading subtitles because you want to take in the full visual of that show. You do. And it doesn't really ruin the show, but yeah, like, on one hand, you have I can't remember the name, the prosecutor and his wife, that whole family area, and a lot of the adults are good, just really good. And then you have stuff like, maybe I shouldn't name names if they're bad performances, so I won't, but some of the younger characters, you're right, like, it is great performances lined right alongside why.
Like Johnny Young Bosch is fantastic as Albert, the protagonist.
Oh yeah, Johnny. I was not talking about Johnny Bosch. I was talking about the younger characters. He does a really good job, really heartfelt. But some of the other ones, my favorite character. If anybody knows who my favorite character is in that, one of the worst performances in the dub. So, yeah, it starts with an F, ends in an ons.
Yeah, holy shit. Yeah, that was pretty insulting because he is a gay character, and from the beginning they telegraphed that with this kind of lisping stereotype voice as just kind of, really?
Why did they do that? Because he's, yeah, it's like, this character is gay, and that in no way informs anything other than just he happens to be. Like, he doesn't act that way, but no, in the dub, let's give him a, that was, why did they do that? Why?
Oh.
He's wonderful. I love that guy. He's like one of the smartest people in the whole cast. Out of the 16-year-olds who are remarkably dumb, but I think... Oh, you mentioned when there's not a whole lot of substance to Count of Monte Cristo. Like, there is. It's, there's substance, but a lot of it is in, look how dumb you are when you're this age, and look what it takes to get you basically, it's a coming-of-age story, but looking at the coming-of-age thing as don't take a step too far. Don't ever lose that optimism that makes you who you are to begin with, because then you won't age into the person you should be. You'll kind of become a monster, and you know there is substance to it. But for the most part, it's an adventure. So I couldn't really lump it in with the entertainment for entertainment's sake sort of thing. There's a little more to it.
It's on my honorable mention list. It's one of those titles that I thought it was worthy of being considered, but just couldn't quite make the cut for me. And I will agree with the comments about the dub. The dub was very hit or miss, unfortunately, on that. There was one point I would kind of mention about the substance issue. It was kind of my understanding that the original novel itself was never really known as being a deep substance novel. It was always much more of an adventure story than everything else, unless I'm mistaken.
No, it was a pulp novel. It was published one chapter at a time in a newspaper, and the series kind of understood that it ended each episode the way that, you know, they would end a chapter in the original run, which is, you gotta, you know, be there next week to see what happens. So, but yeah. The series is deeper than the novel ever was, which is nice.
Cool. All right. So, number four, Count of Monte Cristo. All right, so that brings us to mine, which, speaking of coming-of-age stories, my number four, Fooly Cooly. Not a whole lot to say about this that hasn't been said countless times over the last 12 years. I think more ink has been spilled about Fooly Cooly than a lot of other shows just because it was such a thing in the U.S. after it came out. Easily one of the most recognizable and often seen anime in the West, since Cartoon Network, I think, ran, you know, in its entirety of 6 episodes. I'm going to just guess, and this is a scientific judgment, 400 billion trillion times since the year maybe 2001, 2002. but Fooly Cooly, to me, it falls in with Interstellar in that, hey, look, anime can be really cool. And I also think that the storytelling in Fooly Cooly is really, really great. And it's got a great sense of humor, and it looks great. And I really love the character arc of Naota, and the final episode, to me, has one of the best conclusions to something that is basically feature length in anime that I've ever seen. I get revved up at the end of Fooly Cooly every time, and I've seen it lots, but I always get pumped at the end of Fooly Cooly for those last moments when Naota becomes a man. It's great shit, and there's a reason that thing resonated so strongly with Western audiences, because it represents what animation can do when it's reaching across to actually, like, hey, look, we're going to appeal to as broad an audience as possible while still maintaining our edge. And I feel like that's the trick that Fooly Cooly has, is that it's weird and a little confusing in moments, and it has some crazy shit going on, and it's very edgy, but it's also broadly accessible. And that's because the themes in it are so universal. And the characters are great, and the soundtrack is fucking second to none, and it is just a great show. And I don't feel like I need to say anything more on Fooly Cooly. I've certainly talked about it on this show many times, but it's a favorite of many for a damn good reason. So yeah, Fooly Cooly.
Yoji Enokido is largely to thank for the substance in that. Like, Gainax brought the enthusiasm and Enokido brought the substance. And he did that even for Ouran. Like, he wrote a significant portion of Ouran Host Club, and I think that's what gives it that substance and knowingness that a lot of comedies didn't necessarily have. And Rosaphone, and yeah, anything Enokido touches, he's a welcome presence on a lot of stuff.
Right. Yeah, anybody else have anything to say on that one? It's not that much to add.
I've seen it. I own it. I think it's a fun series. I wouldn't rate it amongst my favorites, definitely, but it's a cool view. I've never really seen it as too much more than just a cool view, though. Probably my favorite episode was actually the one where it focused on the lead's friend from school, the one girl whose father was the mayor or whatever. Right. I actually thought that was probably my favorite episode of it. But I can fully see why people go gaga over that one. It just never had quite that deep an impression on me.
Yeah, I, for whatever reason, I think maybe it's because of the truncated length. Like, it's only 6 episodes. And so the coming-of-age aspect to it comes about hard and fast, and the themes in it are, they're in bold. It's all very bold and pronounced and quick, and that's part of that show's strength, a big part of that show's strength, I think, is the brevity. Right.
I definitely think it's a show that could have outwore its welcome if it had been longer.
Yeah,
totally. And I kind of have that same feeling about that one as I do about Voices of a Distant Star. That was a show that was perfect at its length of 25 minutes. And I think if it tried to stretch that one out, it wouldn't have worked as well. And I kind of think the same thing here about Hula Kula.
Okay. So that brings us to the reader lists for number 4. All right. Hachin lists. Number 1, Paradise Kiss. Number 2, Bakano. Number 3, Gurren Lagann. Land of Obscusion. Your friend of mine lists Fullmetal Alchemist, Ring Ni Kakero, and Akagi. Angel XO3 lists Kurao Phantom Memory. Yeah, that's an interesting pick.
Glad to see that one mentioned.
Number 2, Simone. And number 1, Haruhi Suzumiya. Braves 133 lists number 1, Mind Game. Number 2, Redline. Number 3, Gurren Lagann. A lot of Gurren Lagann. Chrono 831, number 1, Standalone Complex, number 2, Millennium Actress, number 3, Fruits Basket. And from Hazukari, number 3, Planetes, number 2, Interstellar 5555, and number 1, Millennium Actress. So
I really like Planetes, but I guess I should call it an also-ran for me.
It's not quite an also-ran. I watched it, and I enjoyed it, but that's about it.
Yeah.
It's okay.
It's hard to marathon that one.
Yes. Yes, it is. Okay, so we're on to number 3. The end is in sight. Yeah. And let's start our number 3s out with Theron. It's your turn.
All right. Well, my number 3 is my pure all-out balls-to-the-wall fun title choice. And it's also the reason why Bakano is only in my honorable mention instead of on my list. And I'm going to go with Black Lagoon, the Second Barrage.
Okay.
Which is crude, crass, vulgar, quite often ugly, extremely graphically violent, and oh, so much tremendous fun. Right. I mean, we have little kids that come out of snuff films and are basically serial murderers that go around changing identities between each other, and it's fun to watch them going around shooting the crap out of bad guys and then ultimately getting killed themselves. I mean, there's sick stuff that goes on in this series, but it's still fun. And I always found it amazing that the series could pull off something like that. I mean, it's got great characters in it. It's got Balalaika, who won one of our forum tournaments for like the all time best supporting character. Great, great character. I mean, I used to work at a school that was pretty much, you could pretty much call it a ghetto school, and people in that school used to idolize Scarface. Well, that's what Balalaika is. She is Scarface. Well, I think she's more entertaining and appealing character. This is a woman who, wow, there, what's that about a no-nonsense approach to doing business? There's nothing cute about the series at all. For all the fact that it focuses on a character like Revy, who's really built, there's nothing really all that sexy about the series either. I mean, Revy is, wow, she is about as foul-mouthed and contrary as characters come. But yet it's still fun to watch. And I also think it's got quite possibly the decade's best dub on it. Balalaika is dubbed considerably better in English, and I think she was in Japanese. I think there's at least 3 or 4 other roles you could probably say the same thing about that too. It's base, and even I even go for the opening song of it. The song called "Red Fraction" by Mel. It's like an all out like hard rock song from the get go, and that's the kind of song that I would crank up to the volume tremendously on to get myself in the spirit of watching the show. And I'll watch that one like every single time, even if I'm marathoning the series. So, but if I want to just sit down and have mindless, bloody fun with the series, that's the one I'll pop in.
Fun fact, the word fuck appears 259 times in the first season of the Black Lagoon dub.
And probably about that often in the second season, too.
Yeah, I never saw the second season, but somebody made one of those fucking short versions videos of Black Lagoon, and 259 in first season alone.
This is a big hole for me. I've never seen Black Lagoon. I've seen like one episode of it. But the Blu-ray version that Funimation put out of the first two seasons literally just showed up like a couple of days ago, so I am definitely going to get to it.
If you like Bacano, I have to think you would probably like Black Lagoon, because it's got that same kind of, there's all this gross stuff going on, but this is still a joy to watch kind of feel to it, so...
I think if you married Bacano and Standalone Complex, you'd get a little bit of a vibe of how Black Lagoon goes. It's got a little bit more of an episodic nature to it, and more of in those episodic vignettes exploring like why Revy and Rock think the way they do, but not to any ultimate conclusion, just sort of a bebop-ish, this is the life of a mercenary scope. But yeah, it's a really interesting show.
Yeah, this is another one that I'm with Zach on. I think I watched a couple of episodes. And I'm like, I need to finish this, and I never did. But then it went out of print, and then the whole Genion thing happened, and that was years ago, and now I need to revisit it. But I will say I love that song Red Fraction, and it has some of the most hilarious English.
Oh, the lyrics are horrible on it, but it's such a great beat to it. It's one of these places where you can't even get out of that song without swearing going on. So it just kind of sets really superbly well sets the tone for the whole series.
That makes me look forward to seeing it for myself even more. I probably should have watched it for this list, but it sounds like something that I will probably enjoy it no matter what the context. So looking forward to checking that out myself. Okay, so that's Theron's number three, and now we're moving on to Hope. You're number three.
My number three, well, I started started dividing these into, like, what is this trying to achieve, like, facets. My favorite of the best of this kind of thing. And this number three is basically, if I just made a pure favorites list, stuff of this kind, which Princess Tutu is among them, but I kind of kept it in the for kids sort of slant, along with like the Miyazaki, the Ghibli. Princess Tutu shares these traits. Basically taking a uniform vision, but just as you would with the previous thing with Gonkutsuo, Razafon, etc., but taking full advantage of the fact that you are a TV show and not a really long movie, and using, like, having a variations on a theme thing where every episode explores, like, a different theme, a different facet of this big abstract fantasy world you're trying to paint. And the also-rans here are Haibane Renmei and Kino's Journey. This is my favorite kind of anime in the world. I think it's something that can only be done in animation, both because of the fantasy element and the abstraction. But the pinnacle of these things, to me, is Wolf's Rain, my number three. Wolf's Rain is really incredible. It takes the big idea of I don't want to say hero's journey, because that's not really accurate, but sort of the spiritual journey, the pilgrim's progress, or the what have you, of the search for the meaning of existence turned into a series of vignettes or a series of fables, each exploring different aspects of satiation versus aspiration. Like, they have the sort of Brave New World city, and there where they explore that aspect. And there's a doubt explored in a different episode where they get lost in this forest with no food or water, and they slowly turn on each other, etc. And it's all stuff that's been done before, but it's not purely episodic. You get to know these characters, and you really, over time, you just have to fall in love with these characters. Okay, you don't have to. There's a lot of people that don't care for the show, but, like, if you're really getting into it, like, that There's such sincerity to the way they're written, and you really believe in what they're fighting for and how hard they're fighting for it. Even this is a slightly controversial thing for people that like this show. I'm more a fan of the human characters than I am the wolf characters. Like, not just Quent. Quent is the easy one, the crazy hunter. But also Hub and Cher. I got what they were trying to do with that, with the whole yin and yang thing, which is pretty common, but it was done clever here. The yin-yang man-woman flower-wolf analogy that they had going through the whole show. It's really deep, but it is not require you, like Haibane Renmei Kino's Journey and all the best of these kinds of shows, it does not require you to be a very deep thinker and be knowledgeable in this in these you know, mythic standbys to understand what's going on. You can just enjoy it on pure entertainment and drama alone. But if you are a fan of, like, you know, sussing out the, I guess, the roots of where a lot of these fables come from and what the themes are of each episode and how they tie into the overall theme, it's a playground. It's a real playground, Wolf's Rain. And yeah, it's brutal, it's sad, it's uplifting, it's not funny, but it's not a dirge. It's lighthearted in places, and it's gorgeously animated. Very ambitious, and I'm sad that it did not do well in Japan, but it did pretty well over here. So, yeah, it's taking this giant mythic narrative, but also adapting it to the, hey, we're a television show, not a really long movie. Let's also take, like, little side roads and rabbit trails and explore them just as well. And yeah, so my number three, Wolf's Rain, my favorite kind of anime and the pinnacle of what those kind of anime can achieve, I suppose.
Yep, it'll come up later. Yeah. Can't
argue.
We're going
to be talking about Wolf's Rain a lot on this show.
Can't argue with anything you said. So yeah, also not a shock. I know you're a big fan of that show. Yeah.
I guess. Also, wolves are adorable. There's that as another personal bias. It's like, oh, wolves are my favorite animal. That's nice too.
And they kind of go out of their way to make them a little cuddlier in the show than you would normally expect.
I don't know. I was always struck by how animalistic they were. Like, again, why the human characters are a little bit more personable than they are, with the exception of Tobuei, who is essentially a human in wolf form because he's domesticated. But how cold they are. I think that's one of the biggest things that doesn't pull people in is the wolf characters, our protagonists, are cold, and they don't care about humanity. And we're humanity, and we're watching the show, but you have to, like, see from their perspective. Yeah, and they, like, murder people, and, you know.
I think there's a duality. I think you have, I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm not sure I totally agree with that. I think Sue and Kiba are who you're talking about, and then Tobuei and Hige are both.
Yeah,
they're providing,
you're right,
an opposite. The four characters.
Tobuei is completely cuddly, like, completely. Right. But Kiba, yeah, very intimidating, very hard to reach.
Yeah, weirdly, like, the characters, the personalities of the human characters, the human form of the wolves, it's so well realized, the way those characters are written, in terms of, here is a person with a dog's personality. It's done so well, and it's it, to me, it's like the best way you could anthropomorphize something. It's a beautiful way to anthropomorphize the personality of an animal. It's done really, really well. Anyway, we'll talk about
it. Sorry, can I dwell on one more thing really, really fast? I swear it'll be quick.
Yeah.
Okay, well, great example of that. In the first episode, not too much of a spoiler, because this is just something that happens in the very first episode, so sorry if I'm spoiling this, but it's really important, where Tsume and his friends are escaping. They're like, they robbed some giant facility, and they're running off with food and supplies, and somebody falls from a great height, and Tsume reaches out to grab them, but because he's a wolf, he sinks in his teeth, and it shocks them, and they scream, and he drops them. And any human character in that thing, you would have this grief, and they would dwell on it. It's the show is amazingly subtle. You would have this thing of, oh, I let this person die or whatever. But all of Tsume you see is they cut away to a scene of him, like, eating raw meat, eating the heart of this animal away from the rest of his friends, and then coming back to them, and they're like, aren't you sad that this person died? And he's just like, no. But of course he was. We just saw that moment where he's just eating by himself, and he's eating this raw animal. And, you know, it's amazingly subtle, that show. Anyway, enough.
No, That's great. Okay, so, Justin, that brings us to your number three.
Okay, my number three, I've talked about a little bit on the show before, but not a lot. It is one of the truly great TV series, I think, in anime history. It is Seire no Moribito.
I was wondering when this was going to come up.
Yeah, God, this show is really, really good. And again, a fantastic female protagonist, Balsa, who is not exploited in any way for her hotness. She is more maternal in this than anything. And she is charged with the care of Prince Chagum, who, because of a mistaken belief in how their universe works, is thought to be the harbinger of doom for his entire country. And so he is spirited away and left in Balsa's care while she fights off the royal forces. And it is between Balsa and her kind of motley group of friends, they kind of form this ad hoc family unit. And great action, like tremendous action scenes in this. Production IG at some of their best work, honestly. Their action choreography is second to none. But what's frankly just as compelling, if not more so, is that family unit and the sense of community that you get from this show. It sometimes gets bogged down in mythology. There's a lot of difficult Japanese phrases that don't translate at all. And also the English dub has its flaws. This is very much like Gunkutsuo in that there's, you know, a couple really, really great performances and a couple of really crappy performances. But as a whole, it's a show that really leaves this very touching and indelible mark and really emphasizes the power of family and its importance in life in a way that really very few anime even bother lingering on. I mean, family is a concept that in anime is usually done away with. Usually they're just people to die for the protagonist to have motivation. And in this show, it's everything. It's the entire point. And it really touched me deeply. I love this show.
I will be commenting on this one more later.
Okay. It actually didn't make my list. I really liked the show, but for whatever reason, it just didn't quite grab me as much as I thought it would, and I can't quite put my finger on it, unfortunately. It's also something I haven't really spent that much time thinking about. I feel like I owe that show more than I've given it, and maybe one day, but I don't know.
Hmm. Wait, great opening, by the way.
I was like, oh, is this Ghost in the Shell in the feudal era? Because it was, and so maybe I didn't give it enough of a chance. But I don't doubt that it's really good. I own it. I should probably actually sit down and really watch it sometime.
Yeah, you know, we all have holes. Like, here's this thing that I totally should have paid more attention to and just never did for whatever reason. And you know, that definitely falls in there because I didn't even finish it until a month or two ago. And even then, by the time I got to the end, I was like, pretty good. That's sort of my reaction to it, but that's the other sort of downside of consuming as much as I did in that time frame. It's things don't have time to have as much of an impact on you as maybe they should. So, yeah.
Oh, this was part of your marathon?
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah, never finished it before. Yeah. Okay, so that's your number three. That brings us to my number three, which is Razaphon. Which I loved 10 years ago. loved it. And I thought to myself, well, you know, there's a review from me on the site where I gave it straight A pluses. And I'm not, you know, I think that was hyperbole at the time. But I rewatched the show, and it is phenomenal. Razaphon's really good. And as a, you know, all you can do is compare it to Evangelion, and that's, you know, it is from that school of high-minded mecha. Where the world is changing or the world is ending and things are going to change and people are going to remake the world in their own image. And Razaphon, I feel, is a much more complete story in terms of it. And I'm not comparing it favorably or negatively to Evangelion, but it's a very complete story. And I really like what it had to say in the end. And the biggest thing that struck me about this show is that the show's very obsessed with, you know, the whole thing is tuning the world, and it's all this big, it's supposed to be like you're watching a symphony, which is really pretentious, but it works, and the show actually really does build to a crescendo at the end, and the show builds and builds and builds and builds, and then you finally get to where they're going at the end, and you really have strong connections to a lot of the characters in that show. It does feel adult. The show feels like it was written for adults. And I really like what it says. At the very end of that show, it is basically, we're going to remake the world, and the greatest thing any human being can do is dedicating their lives to building loving relationships with the people around them. And it's a really positive show. Like, overall, Razafun is an incredibly positive message at the end. I like it just as much now. Maybe not quite with the hyperbole that I expressed in the, 2002 or whatever, but it's a really, really, really high quality show, and I hope that it gets some kind of a... I think, there are copies that are still floating around out there, but I kind of hope somebody re-releases it at some point. I think it deserves a little bit more attention than it's gotten. I think it's a little underappreciated.
Yeah. It's, I couldn't decide. Like, it wasn't, to me, better that... It wasn't better at, It wasn't better than Count of Monte Cristo at what it was trying to do, and it wasn't better than Wolf's Rain at what it was trying to do, but so it just became one of those things where the way I organized my list, it couldn't be on there. But I adore that show. I've only seen it once. I just never have the time to watch it again, but I'm one of the Evangelion dissenters, primarily because I didn't think it was a complete vision, and I had that same issue with Eden of the East, and, but Razafun is so complete, even if it's not as challenging as Evangelion. Like, it is, it's really reassuring. It is multifaceted. It's a lot like Wolf's Rain. It's early Bones when they were actually doing that sort of thing. It's fucking terrific. And also, dub wise, like, it's got some missteps, obviously, but it and Welcome to the NHK are indicative of what Chris Patton can do when he's given good direction. And, like, Chris Patton's got some amazing depths as a voice actor. Like, he's really talented both in humor and drama, and nothing brings that out quite like either Razafun or Welcome to the NHK for two completely different reasons. Right. On the dub there, but yeah.
I like to compare it, like, if I'm going to compare it to Evangelion, and I know you're not, you're a dissenter, as you said, on Evangelion. They're similar shows with similar journeys, and they have a lot of similar components. But while I can appreciate both of these things, I feel like Evangelion starts to messily scribble angrily outside of the lines, and at least in the TV show, it's scribbling and scribbling, and it gets really violent, but eventually it forms a smiley face. And Razafun is much more a very carefully constructed piece of art. That it's a beautiful painting that comes together completely in the end. It doesn't really stray outside the lines too much, but I can appreciate and love both of these things, and I do love both of them. That's kind of the comparison I would make there. Razafun, great shit.
I think I'm probably gonna be the outlier on this one too. I found I had no desire whatsoever to rewatch Razafun. I mean, it didn't. I thought it was a pretty decently made series, but I always found it needlessly confusing. I thought it was spent most of its series trying to obfuscate the truth much more than it needed to, and that kind of irked me, honestly, while I was watching it. I did kind of like end up liking the ending, but I would put this in my top half for the decade, but not by a whole lot.
Yeah, I don't know. It really struck me for whatever reason. I think it works mostly on the strength of the characters and the fact that the narrative is really well put together. And you're right that it is needlessly vague for a little too long before they finally start giving you the answers. But it's a long show. It's 26. Plus a movie that you really don't need to watch.
Also, what's his, I can't remember his name, but the fellow with the gray hair and the fedora for a large portion who goes a little bit woo-hoo at the end of this series.
Mm-hmm.
The fun thing about him is if you really watch his arc, you'll go, it's Asuka! Like, they have the same character arc and the same internal turmoils. It's great. It's pretty funny.
I'll have to think about that.
It's part of my pile of shame. I will get to it someday. I tried to buy it last year when they were having this ridiculous sale on old ADV stuff, but they ran out.
Yeah. Well, hey, that means you won't get that amazing T-shirt that ADV made that came in the box.
I don't remember this.
I don't know if anyone remembers. There was a while when ADV was putting out Volume 1 plus box, and they would fill the rest of the box with a t-shirt, and the t-shirts were hilariously cheap. So you would get, like, this XXXL Hanes beefy tee with, like, the world's laziest iron-on just sort of slapped into the middle of it. And the Razafun one was really small. So it was this huge white t-shirt with this little iron-on just sort of slapped into the middle of it. It was just some key art with the logo.
Oh, ADV wasn't the only one who did that. Bandai Entertainment did that in a couple of series also, and I still have some of those t-shirts.
Yeah. but let's do some user lists for number three. We need to get into some of these email lists, and we haven't even fucking scratched the surface on Twitter, but here's some email lists. Jeremiah Soraya lists. He has number one, Full Metal Alchemist, 2003. Number two, Eden of the East. Number three, Fruits Basket. Travis Fennell lists. Number one, Moribito. Number two, Paradise Kiss. Number three, Simone. RJ Kirkevold lists. Number one, Spirited Away. Number two, Millennium Actress. Number three, Haibane Renmei. Let's see here. Max Hull lists. Number three, Nine. Number two, Gene Shaft. Really?
Okay. What?
Number one, Birdie the Mighty Decode. Gene Shaft was another one of those "we're screwing around with gender roles" things, right?
That I remember nothing about that show, which tells you a lot.
It was one of those "there's only women" things, I think. Okay, Mod K lists. Number one, Honey and Clover. Number two, Nodame Cantabile. Number three, FMA Brotherhood. And from Eric, he lists number one, Toward the Terra. Number two, Fighting Spirit. Number three, Monster. I was really expecting to see a lot more Monster.
Monster, when I looked at it, like, here's the thing. Great source material. I'm going to get so many people are going to be mad at me for saying this, but it's true. Great source material, slightly artless anime adaptation. Like, it's not bad, of course it's not, because it has terrific source material. But compared to, say, Death Note, because you could, I suppose, compare the two, they really did their darndest to make that be its own thing. So much so that I would much rather watch that and indulge in its bombast than try to read the manga and take it seriously. But Monster's kind of dry. I would rather read the books. You're getting the same experience. They didn't add a cinematicism to it that they really could have. So, yeah, great material, but I don't know.
I think that seems to jive with a lot of what I heard about it. Like, if we did a manga show, top 10, whatever, it would be much more prevalent, I think. You'd probably see a lot more Monster. Okay, into the home stretch here. We're on our number twos, and let's hope you're up first on number two.
Number two, I'm breaking from my tradition of trying to figure out molds for things and just saying, just listing an auteur here, and you had to be somewhere on the list. Sort of a two-way tie between Millennium Actress and Paranoia Agent, one being the best of his works and the other one being my personal favorite. Although it's really hard, I love Millennium Actress a lot, too. I guess the Paranoia Agent, there's more of it, so.
Don't worry, it'll come up.
Yeah.
So Satoshi Kon's work, there's nothing like it. It's really wonderful. It's artful, but completely accessible. Particularly, Tokyo Godfathers, incredibly accessible, meaningful. It's accessible, and yet it says things about Japanese culture at the time that's so really meaningful and makes you, without like turning to the audience and explaining, "No, this was made to highlight, you know, the issues in Japan at this time." Like, there's never any of that, but you get it. You get in tune to what he was trying to say about his own culture, because there's a universality to it. And something that can't be diminished about Satoshi Kon's work is how funny he is. What a terrific sense of humor like that man had in all of his work. All of it. Like, even Millennium Actress, which is maybe the more... Even Millennium Actress has that moment where we cut away to the room and the cameraman is blinking at the two people he's filming acting out the movie, you know. I adore Satoshi Kon's work, but I guess in order to speak really specifically about the two that I pick here, and I can't pick between them really. Millennium Actress is a complete character study, a incredibly compassionate look at a woman's entire life that doesn't feel like any part of it is disjunct. It doesn't feel like any part of it is just like an irrelevant part of her life that she's explaining, because she ties it so neatly into her films that, and the films have meaning, and they have meaning to her, and they have meaning to everyone who saw them, and therefore her life is constructed around them in a way that it has meaning to it. Ah, it's so fucking good. Like, that movie is so amazing. And it's just heartbreaking, and yet it's fun. And there's no other film like it. There's no other film like Millennium Actress, and it could only be done in animation. And then my personal favorite, Paranoia Agent, I just like the concept of it. And the execution, in large part, too. Like, not every episode is gold, but every episode's got some gold in it. And just the concept, the idea, I think Satoshi Kon said in an interview, he was like, well, what was the theory behind this? What was the driving force behind this project? And he said, you know, the little kid that wakes up in the morning and he says, you know, Mom, I have a stomach ache, I can't go to school. And he doesn't really. He just doesn't want to go to school for whatever reason. But he's not lying. You can't immediately accuse the kid of lying, because he will have that stomach ache very soon. He will actually have it. The more that he's convinced that he has it, you know, the more it actually becomes his own reality. And, you know, that's the paintbrush used to draw out Paranoia Agent. And I love the way it comes together. I love the character of Maniwa, because the young detective, because, sad to say, I feel like if I were in his position, that's what would happen to me. And I'm like, you know, they're all sort of relatable in their psychoses, and it's tremendously funny as far as, like, trying to find more humor, because Millennium Actress is a little less on the humor, which is a shame, because he had such a talent for it. Paranoia Agent is tremendously funny. So, not enough can be said about how incredibly intelligent he was, and how he could carry that across to a large audience and a varied audience, West, East, anything like that. Just outstanding auteur works. Anybody should see. I don't care if you're an anime fan or not. Paranoia Agent / Millennium Actress. Could not possibly pick one over the other. But Tokyo Godfathers is great, too. It's more accessible. It just doesn't have the oomph that the other two have to me personally. And although it has a lot of oomph too, I don't know. Just all Satoshi Kon's work. Just that's my number two.
My philosophy about this stuff, because I really struggled with whether or not to put Paranoia Agent and Millennium Actress on my list, and they're not on my list. And I think ultimately it's because they were either going to be number one, or they weren't going to be on the list, and I will put them in their own little special bubble off to the side of, here is an amazing work of genius that just goes in its own place. I just couldn't justify putting it anywhere but number one, but I didn't, you know, ultimately decided these aren't my number ones. But I'm not sure where else I would put them. Putting them lower seems to diminish them. Putting the number one seems dishonest. So I guess I sidestepped the internal argument I was having altogether and said, like, into your special bubble corner, Satoshi Kon, and I'll just concern myself with everything else, because I don't know where to put you.
Yeah, he's a true auteur. Absolutely.
Yeah, everybody knows he's a genius. I mean...
No shock.
I just want to sing his praises. I'm done.
It'll come up.
Yes. Very, very shortly.
There will be more.
Both of these are titles that I basically left off of my top 10 because I pretty much expected other people to be talking about them.
Right.
I really like both of them. I thought Paranoia Agent did some very interesting things in the way it approached things. I also very much like Millennium Actress. I don't want to say that's one of my favorite of the Satoshi Kon movies, but I was still pretty impressed with how it handled its story and everything, too. And it's, in my opinion, it's got one of the great final lines of any anime title at the end of it, where she says something like, in the end, it was all about the chase, or something to that effect. And I always loved the way that wrapped things up, where it did that as she was having this dream about one of her future movies where she's blasting off into space. Now that was used as a kind of a parallel to the fact that she was dying. So I thought that was an excellent bit of execution there, but I just couldn't quite find room for them on my main list. Both of them are on my also considered list, though.
Right. Okay. So hope that's your number two. Then that Theron, that brings us to your number two.
Okay. Well, my top two titles kind of make a pair in some senses, and I think they're probably both say quite a bit about what I really look for in terms of a true quality anime series. They have a lot of similarities. Both are made by the same director, which I didn't realize until I started prepping for this. But it makes a whole bunch of sense now. Both have top-of-the-line visual and technical merits. Both feature strong female protagonists. And both are very intelligently written stories. They just happen to be dramatically different in terms of the way they focus on and the way they tell their stories. The one that I ultimately decided to go number two was Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex Second Gig. I'm going specifically with Second Gig for one particular reason. Although I liked the first series, I absolutely hated what they had the major wearing for most of that series. That little, I don't know, swimsuitish kind of outfit. That just so irritated me. So I was very glad when they stepped away from that in the second series. So that's why I'm going with the second series specifically here. Second Gig is not a series that I would probably classify amongst my favorites, but it's one of those ones that I look at and I have to acknowledge, man, this is a terrifically made series. It's so beautifully animated. It's got convincing action sequences. It's got one of the most complex plots in terms of character developments and politics and everything else that you're going to see in any anime series. And it has smart characters doing smart things. And that's something that I really respect. I don't think you see very much of at all in anime. There's so much anime that's just basically has their characters be stupid for the sake of story convenience. And this is like the exact opposite of that. So it's, again, not one of my favorites, but it's impressed me so much that I could not put it in my list or put it any lower than number two.
Yeah, my relationship with Standalone Complex is, it's a little complicated. Maybe it's not complicated. Basically, my attitude towards those shows is, wow, they sure are, they can be very entertaining. I found Standalone Complex to be kind of dull in large enough stretches to where I didn't consider them for my list.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. It's a kind of a tough slog to get through those shows for me. I mean, I enjoy them when I do watch them, but they're really hard to marathon, almost impossible.
Yeah, I would agree. And frankly, like the characters are a little too cold and detached. There's not quite enough warmth between them. They don't connect to each other strongly enough. I guess.
It has the scent of a procedural in it a little bit.
Yep. Yeah. That's, yes.
Which I was like, you know, I think what you're smelling is procedural, Zach, which I know you have a personal, not so much on.
Yeah. Not a fan of procedurals. Ghost in the Shell totally like that. So, yeah.
And that's pretty much why this one's my number two instead of my number one. Because my number one is not that. So, but we'll get back to that in a few minutes.
Right. Okay. Anybody else comments on Ghost in the Shell?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. I've never connected to it either, so.
All right. okay. So, Justin, that brings us to your number two.
Back to Millennium Actress.
All right. Okay. Figured that.
Yeah, you knew it was coming sooner or later,
well,
especially for me.
If it wasn't number one, it was going to be number two.
Right. I've written and spoken about Millennium Actress on this website till I'm blue in the face, so I'm going to try to come at this from a new angle.
Okay.
I was a film student. I moved to Hollywood in about 3.5 years ago. And over the course of my life, I've had a very kind of a love-hate relationship with actors.
Mm-hmm.
There are some very prominent ones in my life, and there are some that I've met that I, after talking with them, you just want to throw them into a gas station and blow the whole thing up.
Yeah.
Holy crap. I mean, the thing about actors is that they, and it took me a long time to really fully appreciate this. They stop their lives to do their work. in a way that no other profession really does. When an actor is fully committed and they're doing a play or they're doing a film, they're temporarily uprooting themselves, usually moving to a different city for an extended period of time, and they are investing their entire selves into this other person. And they have to strip away everything, every defense mechanism that normally comes with being a human being in society. All of their insecurities are laid bare for us. And the practice of acting is a study of how to do that. And it's terrifying work. And it attracts a lot of, frankly, broken people. But the people that can pull it off either tend to be empty vessels or tend to be people who can live outside themselves and really take in that character from outside and make them part of who they are. And Ammonium Actress has been instrumental to me in kind of getting that. You know, living in Hollywood, they're everywhere. Actors are everywhere. You can't live here without knowing a few of varying degrees of success. And, you know, if you're going to live among them, you have to understand them. And, you know, not all of them you want to get close to, certainly. But the ones that you can make good friends with are absolutely worth knowing. And you have to understand where they're coming from, because acting is such a weird, weird life. And with Millennium Actress is probably the only film or any work of fiction that I've seen that really gets that and finds something to really love and appreciate about it. That's the only new thing I can think of to say about a film that I have sung the praises of about 8 million times. And I keep finding new things to love about it.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting take on that. Every time I see Millennium Actress, and I revisited it at this point, because I didn't see it when it came out. I saw it like a few years later. And I think I've seen it 3 or 4 times since then. And that is one thing I can absolutely say about it, is I totally agree with Hope in that something that can only be accomplished in animation and be convincing and work, and you see something new in it every time you see it. It's one of those kind of films. You discover new things about it that you didn't notice before every time.
God, I'm pissed he's gone.
Yeah.
What a pisser that was.
Trying not to think about that.
Yeah. Sorry.
Jeez, Justin, why do you got to be a downer?
Okay, so I guess that brings us to my number 2, which is Full Metal Alchemist 2003. One of, if not the greatest anime ever.
Yeah. You should just have that carved on your headstone.
I should, yeah.
One of, if not the.
This show, I revisited it in chunks. I didn't rewatch the whole thing. I kind of skipped to the second half, which I feel is where the show's real strength is. But it is shonen action adventure on a scale that I certainly hadn't seen before, and on a level of thoughtfulness and an interest in sincere theme and maybe making some thought-provoking and controversial statements. I mean, this shit has Iraq War commentary in it. Directly. It's not subtle at all. You don't get that out of any shonen action thing. And this thing seemed on the surface like, hey, it's Naruto, except it's alchemy. But that's totally not it. And it has some of the strongest character arcs in it that I can even remember, like in modern memory, in terms of an anime like this. I feel like it doesn't overstay its welcome. It wraps up really nicely. I'm talking about just the TV show. I kind of disregard the movies. I didn't watch Brotherhood. And I think the reason I don't care for Brotherhood or couldn't get into it is because I knew it wasn't going to have the Show Aikawa craziness. And that's what makes, I feel like the Show Aikawa craziness is what makes the 2003 one superior, way more fascinating as a piece of art, and more fun. I like the fact that it doesn't follow the manga and it goes down its own path. And I prefer the characterizations. I prefer the storylines. Everything about it just seems like it's just better. And it is wholly unique. And it's no surprise to me at all that this is the one that really connected with people. And the character relationships in it are incredibly strong. It's got some just really, really strong characterization in there. I specifically, especially like Roy Mustang's storyline. It's a fabulous show that enough ink has been spilled about how great the show is. But there's a reason this one was the huge hit, and it's still no surprise. It holds up really, really well, even now. So, yeah, Fullmetal Alchemist, man. Good shit.
I'll entirely agree that it's probably the best of the Shonen series out there. I mean, I liked it quite a bit more than any of the other ones. It didn't make my list partly because I really couldn't decide whether I preferred the original or Brotherhood. Because while I have some problems with Brotherhood, I do like some of the stuff it did later on in the series. So that was different than what the original did. So basically, they kind of canceled each other out, and I just never got around to putting them on my list. But I do definitely respect the original series, and I did like it quite a bit when I was first watching it. So I have to agree about it being a pretty cool series.
Yeah, it's real special. I think it meant a lot to a lot of people, and I think it still does. All right, so we're on user lists for number two. Excuse me, J.R. Nimenich list number three, Morbido. Number two, Ghost to Shell, or sorry, Get Sack. Is that what we're calling it?
Get Sack.
Number one, Millennium Actress, Lizzie C. LC lists. Number three, Oron. Number two, Spirited Away. Number one, FMA. Fire Axe 428 lists. Number one, Kari no Kyokai. Garden of Sinners. Number two, Saikano. Number three, Razaphon. Isandra, Your Friend of Mine lists. Number one, Mononoke. Number two, Cross Game. Number three, Princess Tutu. Surprised I'm not seeing more Tutu on these user lists. For the amount of, hey, this is a great show that I got.
Well, it's also an underappreciated...
Yeah, I guess that's reflected in the list.
It's got an ardent fan base, but it's not a big one.
Yeah,
they're loud, but they're small.
Yeah. Hitokiri 1 list. Number 1, Toradora. Number 2, Bakemonogatari. Toradora, is that 2010 or is that 2009?
I think it's 2009.
Quite a border.
It is a very good show. Not top 10 worthy for me, but it's a very good show.
Yeah.
Oh, same here.
I did like it. Yeah, I like that show. Number three, Scrapped Princess. Not seen a lot of it.
I saw four episodes of Scrapped Princess just in the I'm going to prepare for this thing. And it was on the list as sort of a joke. But I know Theron really likes it. I was like, well, Theron really likes it. I should give it a shot. I want to see the rest. I'm so going to watch the rest of that. I did not expect it to be that good. I only saw just the first four, but... it's incredibly subtle, which I wasn't expecting, and I want to see the rest. I don't think it's list worthy, hence why I stopped watching it. But yeah, kind of want to see the rest of that.
Yeah, I entirely agree. Scrap Princess is one of those series that's way better than what you expect it to be. You go in kind of expecting one thing, but then it actually shows a lot more depth, especially. And it's character interactions. It's got a pretty interesting premise too, which is what drew me to it originally. I mean, you have a character that is the poison that will destroy the world, and it actually pretty much, nearly literally, proves to be true. Actually, as the story plays out, she's kind of trying to be a good person despite being regarded that way. So I was really fascinated with the way the series played out. It's on my also ran list because it's one of those ones that was kind of like an A-minus series, and I was mostly aiming for the A level series in terms of letter grades. But it's a very enjoyable series. If you like the first part, like the first four episodes, then the rest of the series should work for you just fine.
It's early bones too, isn't it?
I'm sorry. Yeah,
it's early bones, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of the earlier bones titles too. The one thing
something
I
about early bones, man. Just yeah. Well, that first episode, I was like, "Is this the first ep?" Like, I kept going, "Is this? Am I wrong? Like, this is the first episode, right? I didn't pop in the wrong no, it is. And then by the end, I got that it was. And it just, yeah, like, really, really clever writing. It's not, it doesn't feel like adapted from a light novel, which it is, but it doesn't, the dialogue isn't that way.
Oh, yeah, the whole plot of it plays out quite smoothly, too. So you never get to see it. Oh, okay, this is when the first novel story arc ends, and this is where the second novel story arc begins, like you do in a whole bunch of other series. So,
all right, Lost Thief list, number one, Paranoia Agent, number two, FMA, number three, Paradise Kiss. Everybody's favorite forum user, Fence Dude, lists number three, Stelvia of the Universe, number two, Bakemonogatari, number one, Magical Girl, Lyrical Nanoha A's. Thanks, Fence Dude.
That's a lot of taut bottoms.
Yeah. Okay, Shinmaru.
Being honest.
Shinmaru list number three, Kaleido Star. Yeah, first mention of that. Not a surprise that that's the first mention of that. I was okay with Kaleido Star. I can't imagine it making a top three. Anyway,
Kaleido Star was a disc that I recently purchased from my collection.
Yeah, there you go. Number two, Erica Seven. Number one, Monster. Ocha-cha list number one, Bakano. Number two, Princess Tutu. Number three, Millennium Actress. We're getting some sameness in here. Razuel lists. This is a different list. Number one, Aaron the Beast Player. Number two, Kurao Phantom Memory. Number three, Tokyo Magnitude 8.0, which I couldn't get through. I tried to watch that.
It's kind of tragedy porn, isn't it?
Yeah, yep. Yeah, it struck me in a similar way to Saikano, although not as over the top.
Right.
Couldn't get through it, though.
Out of curiosity, Paradise Kiss keeps coming up. Have any of you seen that? Or
oh yeah,
yeah, yeah. I wouldn't put it on a list, but I enjoyed it.
No, it's good. It's. I don't think it's great. I don't think it's as good as. I think relating it to Beck is a good way of summing it up. And I'm lukewarm on Beck as well.
It's Lady Beck.
Right.
Yeah, I saw about the first four. I think I reviewed the first DVD for it, and I thought it was well made. It was just so immensely embedded in what I call shoujo style that I just really couldn't get into it. Because even though I have individual exceptions, I'm really not a big fan of the shoujo style of artistry. So, and that was just too much for me.
I was just curious because it really spoke to. I wouldn't put it on a best list either, except it's one of the best slice of life that I've seen. That's again with like slice of life that's actually remotely realistic. But yeah, it really spoke to me personally. I was like, has anyone else seen that? It keeps coming up. But yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, I like Paradise Kiss. I don't love it, but I enjoyed it. Okay, here's an interesting list. ABCB Tom lists Moyashiman, Ergo Proxy, Book of Bantora, which I think is maybe
Book of Bantora.
That's way out. I think that's
yeah. Yeah, Book of Bantora is a 2010 series, I'm pretty sure.
So sorry, man, but the first two count. Ergo Proxy, really? Okay. Well, someone liked it a lot. Okay. All right. So this is it, guys. We're down to the last category here. These are number ones. And we are going to start with Theron. You're number one, my friend.
Okay. Well, after what I said about my number two, what my number one is should surprise no one. And it is Morbidio, Guardian of the Spirit.
Okay.
Yay.
And I like this one for pretty much the same reasons I like Standalone Complex, Second Gig. But I like it more because, as Justin noted earlier, it's a much more personable story. I mean, these are characters that you actually want to like. You want to root for them and all of this. And I found the whole series much more appealing than Standalone Complex. I respect the series greatly because it's one of the very rare fantasy series that's written intelligently. This is a series where intelligent characters do intelligent things. There's one series and there's one scene in one episode where the group of hunters that's going after Balsa and Chagum actually, instead of just charging off blindly, they sit down and think about what she might do. Then you just see them sitting there thinking the scene goes on for like maybe a minute or two and thinking and discussing what she might do. And it's like, wow, there's so few series that would take the time to do stuff like that. As characters gradually get bits and pieces of the whole mythos behind what's going on, they adjust their actions accordingly. Like the guys at the beginning that seem like they're going to be the the villainous guys from the palace end up starting to gradually realize that there's a bigger picture going on here, and maybe we were actually wrong about all of this. And again, that's not something you really see going on in very many series. Normally, the bad guys are so invested in their convictions that they just can't be convinced of anything else. But no, this series says, oh, no, this is what's really going on here. We need to do something about this and change what we're doing. I found that aspect of the series utterly fascinating. It's got what I think is probably the best series animation of any series that's come out, like, ever for a TV series. It's one of the best, if not the best looking TV series that I think has been made to date. It's got some absolutely fantastic action sequences. Doesn't have a lot of them, but boy, there's a couple of spear fighting sequences in this that are just mind blowing and how beautifully animated they are. There's one of them that's even in like the second episode, if I remember correctly. That's just you just look at this and say, wow, why can't other anime series do this? It's the gem in the crown of Production IG. Had an assist from PA Works, a company that went on to do some fabulous visual work in other series like Hanasaku Iroha and a few others. So it's got an amazing pedigree too. But I think it's the best fantasy anime series that's ever been made. And it's why a couple of other really good fantasy series didn't make it on my list, because this one's just better at every single category.
Okay, great.
Yeah, definitely have to check that out.
Yes, do.
It's like I own it. I just never,
You know, if you don't need the Blu-ray, and the Blu-ray does look nice, not spectacular, but nice. It is an upgrade. But the DVD is so, the DVD box is so cheap.
Oh, yeah. I got mine for like $20, I think.
Yeah.
Like that.
Excellent. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's another one of those with vocal but small fan base. Sadly so. It does
feel, Adult Swim in the twinkling of an eye.
Yeah, for like 2 seconds. Adult Swim. Okay. All right, Moribito. So Hope, that brings us to your number one.
My number one is does not have any also-rans because it's not really a facet or a, you know, trying to achieve a certain thing. It achieves elements of all the things from the entire list, except for Satoshi Kon, obviously. But from everything before, the comedy, the small trails of introspection, the story at large that grips you, the fun aspect, the animation for animation's sake, and a couple places where Bones really just takes off. Hey, early Bones again. It's Full Metal Alchemist, 2003.
What?
Do what?
I was expressing fake shock.
Yeah, well, I love it. Like, it's, I feel bad because it was one of the first adult anime that I'd seen. I was 16 or so, and so it's early, but it's really stood the test of time. I don't think it's just something I saw early, because a lot of people were listing Fruits Basket, and Fruits Basket, you know, like that, I loved that. I watched that all the time, but I've kind of, that anime, I don't really like it. Sorry. It's not bad. I'm a little frustrated with it because it's sort of underachieving and doesn't really go anywhere. Anyway, but Full Metal Alchemist, however, it is the ultimate sort of weird, it's a sort of a weird Philosopher's Stone / Chimera of itself, of just every kind of element that you wouldn't think. Usually you introduce tone shifts like this, which it has some incredible tone shifts of silly, 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 dark tragedy 2 seconds later. That doesn't work, but in FMA, it does. It introduces, fun hijinks and action set pieces right alongside deep, dark, damning, controversial statements about human nature and political subtext, and that shouldn't work, but it does. And it's not just for heady types. And I mean, you can be just a very casual consumer, not even that big into fantasy or sci-fi, and still like it. It kind of accomplishes a little bit of everything without really overstepping its bounds. Like, it's got some it's got some nerds episodes. The Phantom Thief, the tribute to Lupin the Third episode, which is that's the dumbest one. It's the one, like, it's the biggest flaw in the show, because I think it doesn't even feel like it takes place in the same universe. But, you know, it has room to do that. It's 51 episodes. It's got room to make a little some mistakes and not hurt itself too badly. And, yeah, it's sort of a winning blend of everything. You can show it to pretty much anybody. I've shown it to, like, I had a nickname in high school, the Full Metal Netflix. I basically had all 13 discs, and I was a rare thing, you know. And I would pass them through people. One person would have disc 2, the next person had disc 3. Oh, man, I just got through 7. Can you give me 8? No, Julie has 8. No! You know, that kind of thing. It ran through people like water. It just, you know, it is a weird, I guess, thing of taking the best aspects of a really good shonen manga. It is a really good shonen manga, and making it its own standalone thing. It is a true adaptation, in that it is not just copying the manga panel for panel, which, because I hate that. I really hate that. I just don't like it at all when they do that, because it's kind of spitting on the artistic innate, basically the artistic abilities that you have within cinema to do more than that. And it does. It takes advantage of those things, and it becomes a standalone affair. I don't know. Fullmetal Alchemist basically is a creation that does a little bit of everything and doesn't really fuck up any of the things it does. In fact, it excels in many places. So, yeah, number one of the thoughts, I think, because it's just a little bit of everything done well.
Yeah, every now and then, the most popular invisible thing also happens to be one of the best. So, you know, it happens rarely, but there you go.
One of, if not the.
Yeah, okay. God damn it. Okay. All right, I think we've said our piece on FMA. So that brings us, Justin, your number one.
My number one is the shortest thing on anyone's list. It is the short film by Shinichiro Watanabe from Genius Party, Baby Blue.
Okay, all right, interesting.
Holy crap, is this a great little film. And if anyone listening to this happens to have a trust fund, go get a job and give it to Shinichiro Watanabe so he can make more original stuff.
Right.
because he will surely make better use of it than you. And this is the proof. And, you know, when Kids on the Slope came out earlier this year, all I could think about was Baby Blue. Because, and it didn't quite reach that level, and that was maybe a little unfair to that show. But Baby Blue is basically Shinichiro Watanabe encroaching on Makoto Shinkai's area. The, you know, the...
Shtick.
Now.
Yeah.
No, by which I mean the, you know, the long nostalgic shots of empty classrooms and things of that nature. Except Watanabe goes entirely naturalistic. It's not just cranked up contrast and long shadows. It is it's two kids, a guy and a girl, who go off on a day playing hooky, trying to go to the beach. And all of the complications therein, and the real reason why they're there, and their past history together, and it all comes to the surface in a really beautiful and deeply introspective way. And even though there are things like grenades and explosions in there, it's really about coming to terms with being human, with people forgetting who you are, with the things that losing the things that are important to you, and the connections that define your life. The ending to this day devastates me. I cry at the end of this every time I watch it. It is, it's spectacular. I think it might be my number one anime ever made. I've shown it to more people than I can think of. I just love this thing to death, and I wish there were more things on this planet like this short.
Wow. Okay.
I can't say I've ever even heard of this one, honestly.
Most people haven't, so it's good that you're bringing it up. And it's also interesting to point out that Genius Party is one of those things where you select one piece of it because it doesn't come together as a whole, like a film.
It really doesn't.
So you pick one piece, and I totally get what you're saying, and I have seen that, and you're right. It is an incredibly powerful piece of film. It didn't, you know, I didn't consider it for this list. I didn't think of it. But you're right. That thing is amazing. People should seek it out.
Yeah. Mind-blowing. It's too bad that you cannot get Genius Party legally subtitled unless you get the Australian import.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing that just doesn't really get released over here.
And most of it doesn't deserve it to be, frankly.
Yeah, a lot of it's pretty... That is unquestionably the jewel in that crown. Like, that's it. Like,
yeah, there's a couple other good ones. That's the only great one, and a whole lot of crap.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. All right. Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I think I'm going to watch that again pretty soon. It's good stuff. Okay, so that brings us to my number one, which will come to surprises no one. It's Dot Hack, Legend of the Twilight Bracelet. Now, I don't know if you guys have seen this, but...
Wow.
You got to keep going. You can't break off here. You got to commit to the joke, man.
Okay.
Come on, Zach. Paragraphs. Keep going.
Can't do it.
Keep going. Come on. Dance monkey.
No, obviously it's Wolf's Rain. Wuff's Rain, as I affectionately refer to it sometimes.
Wuff.
This was not on when Justin, you and I did a top 10 all-time list like a couple years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, and it wasn't even on there. And that's because I hadn't revisited it in a long time and hadn't even really thought about it in a long time. And that's because I hadn't seen a frame of it since 2002, whenever it came out. And then we revisited it about a year later. I think I was like, you know, I really liked that show because I remembered it suddenly. And then I rewatched it. And I fell in love with it so hard all over again that if we were to redo the all-time top tens, it would be probably number two. This show, I feel like it does a better job making me care about the characters and simultaneously being introspective and yet also writ large, like it's an apocalypse story writ large that's also a very small character drama, that's also an absolutely gorgeous fantasy movie, that's also a heartbreaking human drama story. It's got everything. And you really care about all these characters, and the show goes way out of its way to draw these characters as detailed as they can. And you feel like you really understand all of these characters. And I feel like chiefly the reason that I like it so much, it has, I think, the strongest ending I've seen in an anime series. Next to maybe Utena. It has one of the strongest endings ever. Those last four episodes, the OVA episodes, are powerful and heartbreaking and really clever and incredibly well written. And it is the kind of thing where you're wrapped up in it and you can't look away and you care so much fundamentally about what's happening in the show that you forget all your problems and you're inside this world. And I really can't recommend it enough. One of the probably Yoko Kanno's best work in terms of soundtrack, which that's saying a lot. Like that's
it's a diverse soundtrack. It's like every piece is really kind of different from all the rest, but it feels like it all belongs in the same world for some reason.
Yeah, exactly. Somehow it all fits together, and there's no reason the show should be as good as it is. None. Like it's kind of a weird. It's a really weird idea that could have just gone the wrong way right off the bat, but it's so perfectly executed. It's got a great dub. The dub is very good. I think so anyway.
Absolutely.
You really care about all the characters, and it breaks your heart over and over and over and over and over again. But the ending, which a lot of people had a problem with, but again, like internet comments, whatever, I felt that the reset switch ending was brilliant. Like, I thought it was totally brilliant. Like, and a really smart way to say what the show was ultimately really trying to say. Close to the best thing I've ever seen in terms of anime. It's not quite Utena, but it's up there. Wolf's Rain, man. That is the shit. You gotta get it.
Boy, after listening to you and the others talk about this, I feel like I must have missed something when I watched this show, because I found the ending horribly depressing, and not at all involving or appealing. Honestly, I never really cared about most of the characters in this series. So it's just like I'm listening to you guys rave of this. And it's like, wow. I mean, this was so not my experience when I was watching this series at all. I'm just kind of baffled here, honestly, by all this. So
I will say
it didn't work for me or something.
The head writer of the series is Keiko Nobumoto, and she's really obtuse, and in a good way. I love the subtlety of her writing, but it, like, emotionally, Wolf's Rain is, I'd like to say, very accessible. Although it depends on who you are, but I like to say that Wolf's Rain is incredibly emotionally accessible, but intellectually, in order to make that ending not just make you feel like you've been, you know, thrown in a ditch, you got to be paying pretty close attention because, yeah, I get completely why it's divisive.
Without engaging in spoilers, I think it's really the key to understanding the ending is really in the epilogue, because the fact that that is there is the crux. It's the values of the main character. Is the reason why things turned out like that.
Right.
And that's
they
that's
show the you little shots of every other character for a reason. Watch what every single one of those characters is doing in those little shots. And the skyline, like they've said, I can't say without spoiling, but like that skyline is focused on for a reason because it's supposed to be familiar to the Japanese viewer. I don't know.
Yeah. It is a work of artistic and emotional beauty that I feel like the first time I saw it, I knew that, but getting older and watching it again, having gone through, because I saw this show when it came out, which was about 10 years ago now, and you know, in those 10 years, expanded my knowledge of film and everything I loved about it, and revisiting it just made me made me appreciate it and love it even more. Yeah, no. Wolf's Rain, man. Great, great stuff. Can't say enough good things about it.
And there's a giant walrus.
And there's a giant walrus. and I'm actually okay with that episode. I'm fine with it.
You have to be.
okay, so let's do the last of the user lists. And then, miraculously, we're finished. last of the user lists here. Okay. Hisui RT lists. Number 3, Galaxy Angel. Number 2, Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex. Number 1, Planetes. MNaxer lists. Number 1, Girl Who Leapt Through Time. First mention.
Wow. If it weren't for that third act, I would have been on my list.
Yeah, it's a shame about the end of that movie. Number 2, Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood. Number 3, Monster. Jarvis Gray lists. Number 1, Gurren Lagann. Number 2, Kamichu. Number 3, Magical Shopping Arcade Abenobashi. Also the first mention.
Really? Do people like that?
I have no opinion of that show. I've seen it. I have no opinion of it. Commodore Wood lists. Number 1, Princess Tutu. Number 2, Honey and Clover. Number 3, Kaiba. Real J. Castro lists. Number 3, Black Lagoon. Number 2, Gurren Lagann. Number 1, Millennium Actress. Brandon White 91, and this may be a testament just to the people who listen to this show. Number 3, Canon, first mention of a key show. no Clannads, no nothing. At least obviously haven't read all of these, but I didn't see any mention of those. No Clannad, no Clannad after story. I think I maybe got one or two Clannad after stories. But anyway, number 2, Summer Wars. Number 1, Baccano. Cross Maps lists. Number 1, Princess Tutu. Number 2, Full Moon Osagaste. First mention of that. Number 3, Kurao Phantom Memory.
I like Full Moon, but the ending is one giant Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah. Indeed. all right, let's wrap up here. Let's go with Zump 1 list. Number 1, Monster. Number 2, Paranoia Agent. Number 3, Moribito. And, okay. We should list this. Columnist for the site, Lindsay Lamb, lists number 1, Gankutsuo. Number 2, Bokurano. First mention of that one. Number 3, Paranoia Agent. And, you know what? Let's call it there. We got a ton of lists. We might do something with some of this data. We have so many of them, but couldn't tell you when or why we would do that. But anyway, that wraps it up. That's the end of our best of shows, or revenge of shows. I cannot thank Hope and Theron. I cannot thank you enough for doing this with us. I know that was a long slog, but your contributions were invaluable, and it was really great hearing your take on everything. So thank you so much for coming on and doing this with us.
A lot of fun. A little therapeutic.
Kind of was, isn't it?
Okay, that's our show. I want to take just a quick second here to say a big, huge thank you to all of you listeners for making 2012 so special for us. This episode wraps up the year for ANCAST, and we couldn't have done it without you guys. We love making the show so long as you love listening to it. And each and every one of you, it's invaluable to us. So thanks for listening, and we're really looking forward to another year of great shows in 2013. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a little rating, a review, and we will see you all next year.